the mixtape with Scott. I am Scott. Scott Cunningham, a professor of economics at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. And this week's guest is a professor of economics at Toulouse. He's had a neat story, a story that has taken him through a very curious kind of mindset as a young man, ends up following him his whole career, and has managed to take that kind of incessant curiosity and broad general interest and really kind of strike out and make his own stamp. His name is Daniel Chen. And I think that if you look at Daniel's vita, which I'm going to place in the Substack as well as the Spotify, Apple kind of little spot there, as well as YouTube, you'll know that you're going to recognize some of these papers. The one that we're going to talk about has to do with a study he did where there was basically a workshop of law and economics faculty that were basically training judges. And he looks at the effect of that training on their court decisions. That's one of the things that you're going to hear with Daniel is Daniel doesn't just collect data. He collects data that, you wouldn't know what to do with it. And it's a lot of textual data. And he asks very, very ambitious questions drawn from that broad interest in philosophy, law, history, psychology, as well as econ, that I think makes him such an interesting, exciting person. But I was going to also say Daniel fits in my, big picture stuff, because not only is he, part of the story of economics, he was a student of the Nobel laureates. When he was at MIT, his committee consisted of Michael Kremer, Banerjee, Esther DeFlo, and Josh Angrist. It was the Justice League of major impactful economists in the area of microeconomics and development, and really dialed into the experimental design tradition. So of course he checks off so many boxes, and just is a fascinating man. And I wanted everybody to hear his story, and I hope that you get a lot out of the story. Thank you so much for supporting the podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoy it. I'm gonna turn it over to the previous Scott Cunningham that just existed an hour ago. He's now dead. I took his place. And Dr. Chen, I hope you enjoy this. Bye-bye. Or see you in a minute. All right. Well, it is a pleasure to have someone that I've already feel like I've known for a long time when we met recently and had breakfast together and talked. For the sake of the listener guest, will you tell me your name, your title, and the name of the firm that pays your pay bill, your pays your bills?
Sure. All right. So my name is Daniel Chen, a professor of economics at the Toulouse School of Economics and director of research at CNRS, which is the French National Research Association.
Okay. All right. Cool. All right. Well, let's do an icebreaker before we get started. Susan Athey told me that you're not supposed to ask people what's your favorite because their brains can't think in superlatives. So this is what we're going to say instead. What's a vacation that you took growing up? Maybe it wasn't your favorite one, but you've remembered it since then more than one time.
So I grew up in Texas. I don't know if we talked about that when we had weeks ago. And my family, we just drove around almost the entire 48 states in the continental US for years. So like Grand Canyon, Florida, California, like all that stuff is a Yellowstone. Yes, we went when it was on fire back. The 80s or 90s. And so it's all wonderful experiences. A big blur of sitting in the back seat with my older brother, pushing the igloo to create more space, reading books. So how do you pass time, right? So
I love our country. When you see the country from the car on the road trips, you realize, Well, when you're with your family and you do the road trips, it's so nice. It's such a beauty. And you go really far seeing those national parks, even when they're on fire.
Indeed.
All
Indeed.
right. So you grew up in Texas. Where in Texas did you grow up?
We spent 6 years in Houston and 4 years in Dallas, Fort Worth.
Okay. What'd your mom and dad do for a living?
So my mom, so she wanted to study medicine, but her dad said no because she was a woman. And
No.
anyway, when we came to the US, or when they came to the US, she was a stay-at-home mom. And then eventually, when I went to Maryland, she went to work doing library science at NIH.
Oh, okay.
On my dad's side, he's a statistics PhD and doing biostatistics and like pharma, academia, government, moving around, in part because they constantly were looking for better schools. So it's, in some ways, it's a standard immigrant story of, when they first moved, they were bread and water for lunch every day, no heating, air conditioning, the hot and cold Chicago weather. But yeah, no, I mean, it's obviously they wanted to give opportunities for me and my brother to have like a better life. And when we moved to Maryland, I think it was in part because they knew about some of the math and science schools, the DC suburbs, and that probably was a very formative experience for me.
Okay. So that y'all were in Houston and Dallas, and they're watching you age, and they were like, these schools aren't going to work.
That's my understanding. I think
Okay.
I was young to, just like reading all the books. I skipped a grade or something, and yeah, we went from like 1 year in a private school and then the rest in a public school, and but yeah, it was, I mean, it was great, obviously, but in some ways, growing up as an immigrant, it's like a lot of suburbs. You're just in a car,
Yeah.
so I don't know if it's that specifically different, though I think on reflection and given today's topics of educational polarization and everything, I imagine things were relatively different in how history and social sciences are being taught. But
So how much, what's the age gap on you and your brother?
he is 4.5 years older.
Oh, okay. Were y'all close at all growing up? Yeah. Okay. Well, so if I could have found you on a Saturday when you were like, fourth or fifth grade, what would I have, just like a random Saturday, what would I have found you doing?
My mom would be driving me to the different libraries.
Oh, yeah.
Go to one library, check out a bunch of books, then go to another library, check out a bunch of books, go to another library, check out a bunch of books.
What books were, so what were you a big reader of? What'd you
Well,
love?
just about everything. Fiction, nonfiction. I wasn't introduced to like science fiction until 7th grade, but so when I was younger, it was just, a mix of everything. I do remember I would intentionally go to the 900 section of the Dewey Decimal to pull out books with maps. So I loved maps as a kid. So like the history of something. Oh, I was really into history. So seeing how like all the movements of countries and everything shifted over time. I also loved looking at weather maps. So fun fact is, 1 year I clipped out the weather maps every day in the newspaper. So the end of the year I could flip through them and look for patterns. So yeah, anyway, I was
What'd your dad think? Seeing, I mean, did he, him being a statistician working with data, did he start to, you think he kind of noticed something, you being like that? Or your mom?
In fact, one summer he had me and this other high school kid do statistics Oil. It was fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think. Oh, we also had, kind of this emphasis on like schooling and education. Starting in second grade, we had homeschool stuff during the summers.
Oh, okay.
That's when history and social sciences really became sort of more living, I guess, in a way, because you're getting exposed to the material in one perspective, and then you get exposed to the material in a different perspective during the school year that just felt like all these different things fitting together. The math stuff was a little bit more just a bunch of exercises, so it didn't seem
Yeah.
as so. Yeah, my Saturdays were maybe not as what wasn't the outdoorsy type.
Right. So were you going to one of those big STEM math, math science high schools then in Maryland?
Yes, so I went to Montgomery Blair. It's, I guess, it started in the 1980s with the intention of like busing kids around the county to create more of a demographic mix. It was a great experience. I think it was early exposure to like computer programming, a lot of exposure to like the scientific method. We had in ninth grade, we had to submit a proposal to run an experiment on a space shuttle. And then in 10th grade, like do your own thing for a semester and then present it to the class.
Wow.
So we decided to like build transistors to measure signals that would then imagine it's like a satellite getting signals to triangulate where you are in space. Anyway,
Wow.
but yeah, no, I mean the, but I think the most, some of the, and this maybe transitions a little bit into economics, the more formative classes were like AP European History, AP English, which is psychological perspective. So even with all the math science and computer science, it was definitely always the, I guess, the softer social sciences that drew my imagination, or what would be the first thing you would do in terms of like homework assignments or something that I think shaped what I do today.
Did you maintain a big, heavy reading hobby during all throughout high school?
I did. In fact, all the way through to grad school, where I would attend an economic seminar, and then if I was feeling a little strange about it, the Harvard University Press bookstore had this discount section, so everything like 10% off. Like
Oh.
books from all the other disciplines outside economics. Point, I would just like have this huge collection in my credit housing that my friends were just a little bit like just a little weird. Yeah, no, I mean, I think kind of dictate sort of where I try to study. If I went to a library, I'd get too distracted from pulling random stuff off the
Yeah.
shelf. But yeah, no, it's a I'm skipping ahead. So yes, in high school, definitely still was reading books and then continued that habit.
What, so if, I mean, I bet your teachers, I mean, I don't actually want to put words in your mouth, but like, were you sort of, I bet you were maybe unique. In a high school like that, having such broad interests, what do you think they thought about you?
Well, actually, the high school was a very nerdy in a way. So I don't think I was that outlierish. Just to give you an example, so the largest team, based off of the photograph in the yearbook, was the physics team.
Okay.
Which is kind of a sense of folks found socialization over academic stuff. And I mean, maybe. Obviously, I think, I don't, I'm not in the minds of, my teachers and counselors. I don't,
Well, on a scale of one to
my friends were, they're very, some of them are prominent mathematicians today. So
okay.
in a
Well,
way, I'm
on a
the black sheep of we didn't have any exposure to economics or law, so it was all like math, sciences, medicine and stuff.
Oh, okay. On a scale of 1 to 10, then 10 being like the best high school experience you could have ever had, what would you rank that high school experience of, was it like for you?
It was great. No,
You loved it.
I enjoyed it a lot.
Okay. So then you go to Harvard. You graduate in 1999. That's when I graduated. So we're both, are you class of 94 for high school?
Class of 95?
95, but we're both Gen X.
Correct.
Yes. Okay. We're both Gen X. I stayed an additional year of because there was a big poetry contest that I missed in 98 when I should have, when I was supposed to graduate. So then I waited a year, didn't take classes in the spring, the fall, took my classes in the spring, and then won the poetry awards. So I was graduated in 99. But so you get to Harvard and then you sort of sort into applied math and econ. And so I was just curious, before we get into that, what was it like? What was it like for you stepping foot on that school? I mean, that must have been really cool.
Yeah, no, it was very cool. Classmates that are really interesting, ambitious, in their own paths of life. I think initially I had a little bit of some culture shock. It wasn't as math and sciencey, for instance, but yeah, no, I mean the liberal arts stuff was great. Being exposed to different ways of knowledge, the ECTN sequence, of course, was something that took as part of that distributional encouragement, and then seeing it as like a combination of math, history, and psychology, I think, as
Yeah.
well, further into economics.
That was Marty Feldstein. He was the one that taught you ECTN.
Yes.
Oh, so what was that like? What was he like as a professor?
Yeah, no. So there's actually like th three pillars to that class. There's Martin Feldstein, but then there's also all these other guest lecturers on specific topics. So you get exposed to basically, the entire breadth of economics.
Oh.
And your section, so like a graduate student is like teaching a lot of the heavy concepts. And then of course the textbook. I mean, I think the textbook was bomb on blinder, and it was again bookworm confessing, but no, it was page turner. It's really interesting to see, oh wait, you can understand like people's motives, and also like what's society optimal in some kind of social planner perspective. So just kind of this spectrum of understanding humans, explaining patterns in history, and a little bit of engineering and math at the end. That
Do you think that you almost could have gone into psychology or history because you're really interested in human behavior and you're really interested in history? What was the a lot of people would hear econ, a guy interested in psychology, human behavior, and history, and then they'll hear you major in econ. They can't figure it out. What's the tipping point? What kept you out of those other two?
well, I liked math. I liked kind of the structure, and in some ways, I think because of the previous experience, the math stuff came a little bit relatively easier.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, but yeah, I can't emphasize enough how much I was also interested in lots of other things too. So,
Yeah.
as choosing applied math, you have to choose like a secondary, like a field of specialization. It's choosing between economics, biology, and meteorology.
Oh,
So,
you just have like you're a Renaissance man. You just have so many broad interests. Is that a fair? Has somebody ever called you that, a Renaissance man?
no, you're the first, I
I'm the
believe.
first one. Yeah. Well, you are. You have so many broad interests. Is that they've said you're just a naturally curious person, maybe?
Okay, someone at my graduate advisors said I was like a kid. Curious in this, that, and that. But yeah, that's not the same thing as Renaissance man. Just kind of like you're in a candy store with different.
Well, how does that make you feel? What you when you're curious like a kid, is it driven by love and I love this material, or is it like awe, or what are the feelings you feel when you're sort of doing that kind of broad reading or just engaging?
It's like trying to, well, there's the stories, so
Yeah.
that's pulling you in. Then there's this trying to understand like the broad patterns. What are the
Yeah.
possible rules, rules of human nature or rules of societal development, and trying to conceptualize that, and whether that's either like a formal math thing or then the empirical dimension, I think, is something that economics does much more so than at least history.
Well,
Psychology.
what's a book from Harvard that the days of college, again, not your favorite book, but like you think, I've thought about this book even now, you're like my age and you found yourself have thought about it a few times. What's a book like that really seems to have left an impression on you?
So, Exit, Voice, and Loyalty.
What is that?
So he's a like a economist, political scientist, and argued that a lot of like local public goods provisions and or schooling, there can be pressure if people are voting with their feet to Tipu theorem type
Oh,
stuff.
yeah.
But then there's the loyalty dimension, which is, you might actually kind of want to stay and like try to improve things. So it was kind of a broad, well, it was definitely more qualitative than mathematical piece on trying to understand, how governance works in society.
Oh, governance.
That was interesting.
Huh.
Another book that was interesting was The Bible as It Was. That was taught by James Kugel. I'm probably his name, but just going through like lots of different stories on like how all these things that you might read about, growing up in Texas in the U.S. South, might have like different interpretations that were more economical.
Oh.
So.
Yeah. That governance thing, though. That had you always been interested in governance? Even back then in college?
Well, the idea that there could be a mathematical way to understand how to improve governance, mechanism design theory, social choice, all that stuff. I mean, so that stuff, that vertical was interesting and attractive. And I guess the other story on how I went to econ grad school, so one is the introduction to economics, but the other was this class, Industrialization of East Asia by sociologist, again, part of this liberal artsy type distributional requirements. And it really emphasized how economic ideas had consequences for shaping and improving development.
Okay. Wait, what was that class?
Industrialization of East Asia.
Oh, and they emphasize rather than just emphasizing technology or capital, they're emphasizing ideas.
Economists, technocrats,
Oh, so that sticks in your head.
that sticks in my head.
Yeah. Huh. Okay. All right. So if you had stopped in 1999, having spent that time in econ and applied math, but then didn't go on, what were you thinking about instead of going on to become a professor? What were you thinking about as other possible careers?
Well, Well, so the end of college, I think I was already pretty set on going to graduate school, and then I went to Oxford for a year to try to find out what I was interested in, like research. Probably the early part of grad school I was, still not, sorry, early part of undergrad, I still was not sure, maybe I want to go into the natural sciences. So I, interned at NIH for a summer and did stuff on virtual bronchoscopy of, excuse me, sort of more medical related, but it didn't really resonate with me.
It did not. Wait, so what kind of work was that? Was it more medical?
Yeah, I was medical. I was doing a lot of Fortran programming. Fortran's my first computer language. We would like modeling like the data that's coming from a camera that's being stuck down your bronchoscopy or esophagus, one of those
Yeah.
two.
Was that because you were thinking about med school?
I briefly did, and as part of the pre-med requirements, I took evolutionary biology, which was also very formative, sort of thinking about not only like population biology, but just what did we read? We read all this stuff, like Yanomamo tribes, like all this small-scale societies, and then evolutionary perspectives to explain what people were seeing, which is
Oh,
saying
yeah.
economics, right?
Right,
Like
right.
proposing a theory that has some kind of mathematical structure on.
Sure. And change the idea that these things are endogenous, like even things you're observing can change over time. Oh, huh. Are you taking all this stuff? Or are you like, you're going and doing these internships because you really are someone who learns what your preferences are by doing them? Or was there like a plan?
No, I think it was the more the former. So my second summer I spent part in Scotland doing like some parallel computing applied to, I can't remember now, but that tells you how memorable it was. And then I spent like a month in economic consulting or something, because part of that was like a thing that folks might consider, with applied math economics. But I think I was already pretty set on wanting to do, research and economics research, and
You
then.
started feeling that. You started feeling that towards the, at some point you're like, is this how it was? At some point you're like, these are really fascinating, but I keep thinking of these applications to human society rather than just like biology and things like that. Was that what was in your head?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you apply for, you don't spend a ton of time outside of between school. I mean, you go to Oxford, but you apply and you get in and then you end up going to MIT. That must have also, again, I mean, just what you've said, being really interested in history and the stories, was being at MIT sort of like, I mean, that's like one of the most storied departments in the world. What did that feel like going, stepping foot into the, one of the most exciting, one of the being at Paul Samuelson's department? What was that like?
It was great. I mean, obviously that's it's a privilege to be able to attend and sort of get the kinds of like teaching, every paper, sort of thinking about how it can be improved and what are the next couple ideas or from each of the classes. The lunches and seminars were it's like learning by listening. So sort of me coming in, having all these, curiosities, but then how to go from those curiosities into a paper, I think
Yeah.
was the biggest learning experience in the first year and a half.
You start
And
writing papers? Did your curiosity that had always been a consumer Are you like translating that into a being a producer pretty quickly?
Sort of. So for my secondary econometrics paper, I was interested in the idea of paradigm shifts.
Yeah.
Back then scraping wasn't really a thing. So it's, what was it? You build spiders or web crawlers collecting, academic papers and then trying to, here's a biological analogy where you imagine like on the walls of the Museum of Natural Science, like a phylogenetic tree, and then you pass a doorway, there's a mass extinction event, and then the future part of the tree comes out of the small part of the previous tree. And I wanted to operationalize that statistically. So I was like collecting lots of data, and and that had some trade-offs with coursework. Macro, first year macro is like starting in the spring of your first year and then falling to the fall. I think my last macro, I was not so good a student, but as a kudos to me taking the exam a second time, the professor's work actually then applied to sort of questions I was interested in terms of like law and development. So like, incentives underlying things that we now view as human rights violations and stuff. Don't think he was intending his macroeconomic model to be applied in that direction, but that's what I did. Just kind of turn lemonade to lemonade, but also absorb things and just apply it to the things that I saw around me,
Yeah.
curiosity.
So you end up working, I mean, with like an all-star committee. You've got Esther DeFlo, Banerjee, Michael Kramer, and Josh Angrist as your advisors. Who's kind of your main advisor of those of that committee?
Esther.
Esther is. Well, so before I ask about that, had Banerjee written his herding paper by the time that you're like doing that? And Mike,
Yes.
so were you interested in these kinds of like those kinds of theory papers, also as opposed to just like, did you imagine, I mean, a person with an applied micro, I mean, sorry, with an applied math background, interested in theory evolution, I mean, interested in things like stories and evolution of society. If you, I could imagine so easily that you would have been, you would have gone into this like writing a herding paper or just doing sort of these very innovative theoretical papers. Was that it ever on your topic that that's where you were going to go?
I did indeed go to grad school thinking I would do like theory or applied theory. There was something, well, firstly, a positive way to view my research genesis here is that all the earlier exposure to the scientific method, experiments, programming, which obviously is very relevant for data, that I think is like the 70% of,
Right.
what I was doing. I'd say 30% is there was some kind of dyslexia between like math and words. Let's leave it at that. So it's not like economic theory and like these papers, it's constantly you have to go back and forth between the math and the words, and very different from kind of more applied math, engineering math. Anyway, I
Well,
mean,
so this is like what, like early 2000s? You start sorting into those relationships with those four peoples and especially Esther DeFlo. That would have been like 02, 01 or something.
yes.
So how do you and her end up matching? How did that happen?
Well, I mean, so I mentioned I was interested in development issues, development questions that drew me into economics. So I took development. Also, I'm not sure exactly the genesis of what came first or not. So I mentioned paradigm shifts as the second year project, but then my
Yeah.
market paper turned out to be about religious fundamentalism, which is all ideas and beliefs and incommensurability. But I was using Indonesia and its financial crisis as the natural experiment. And since she had, used the Indonesian school expansion as a natural experiment, and was in some ways kind of a failure in terms of methods and setting.
Oh, okay. How'd you get interested in that question of the religious fundamentalism? And which country did you say it was?
Indonesia.
Indonesia. Okay. What religion fundamentalism are we talking about?
This was Islamic resurgence, crisis, and then 9/11 had, just happened, and
Oh, got it.
a lot of, interest in trying to understand, what drives these beliefs slash, governance with a lowercase g of the organizations. And I was trying to show, does economic distress increase religious intensity in the first place? And then the form of social insurance that, people have, different shocks all the time. And so you could collectively agree to be insuring each other. But then what made religion special is that it could be ex post insurance. So you get hit hard, you can decide to join. And then what keeps it self-sustaining is that there can be sanctions against people who are leaving or in another group. That's kind of how it all sort of fit together. But it was
Is that
lucky.
drawing on Larry Iannacone's sort of sacrifices and stigma concepts?
Yes, it was drawing on Iannacone, Ellie Berman's work, those some of the theoretical models of Clarence Jenico at Georgetown and some other macro folks that had been writing about stuff at the same time.
But you're applying it to governance questions. Is that because of 9/11? You're applying it to these governance questions about that these sort of religious groups are sort of like, what's the governance exactly? How do I think
So,
that?
what makes an organization that's like a religious sect or a group work and bring people in, make it self-sustaining? So if people can get negative shocks and then join the group, then you could always leave afterwards. So then you don't get like that fiscal self-sustaining dimension.
Oh, I see. I see. Is that framed as a free riding problem, or is that framed as like the need for to survive and like over a multi time period? That's not exactly the free riding kind of stuff Iannacone's talking about, right?
It's related. So, he talks about strict clubs or something. So it's like a club where, you have all these extra costs that are, imposed, and that makes the club kind of more economically optimal. I then had applied that framework as a postdoc to thinking about why the religious right tends to be against the welfare state in the US, because if, welfare or, government's there to provide alternative forms of insurance, then it competes against a constituency. That's what
Well,
a
so
little
did you end up publishing that?
So the Indonesia paper was published in the JPE.
Oh, that's fantastic. That must have felt great. Was that sh shortly after you graduated?
No, that was my first experience at a journal. It took 2 years. It was, I guess a negative draw in terms of how long it took. No, I ended up publishing it in 2010. I
Oh,
graduated.
okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, so you graduate. And when you graduate, you do not immediately go into academia. You decide to get a JD at in you decide to go to law school at Harvard. What did you feel like? Well, okay, I'm going to put words in your mouth, and then you tell me that, Scott, that's inaccurate. But one interpretation would be you felt like something was missing, that like, you are missing some piece of human capital. But is that accurate? What was the reasons for you to go to law school?
I don't know if that's the right framing. So as a postdoc, I found my work moving the direction of law and development as opposed to pure economic development. And then I was always interested in like the role of law and courts and affecting social change, changing, people's beliefs about what's fair, just, and so forth, rights. rights revolutions.
Mm.
So given that neither law and development or this law and norms work was that bread and butter for economic development, much less economics, I thought, well, law school was very interdisciplinary. Maybe there's some more substantive overlap with the stuff that people work on there. When I went to law school, it was definitely with the idea of, I'm interested in, still interested in, research and having more of a exchange with the legal scholarship, but then found, I guess, both the development folks there were not so interested in economics. Second, sort of a huge new research slash data in terms of, every day you're discussing the judges' normative commitments, what they thought was fair and just. And you're hearing your classmates sort of say, oh, look, I disagree, and this is why, and how could it have been better? And so part of this went into, well, judges are randomly assigned. In 2006 was the first paper. And I was told in 2007, these circuit judges are randomly assigned. And I thought, okay, we're spending all this time in class and reading in these opinions, hypotheses about the potential effects of the rulings, but no data. And so obviously, influenced by Duflo and Evangeline Angus and also Kramer, in terms of how can we get better evidence for policymakers, I thought, well, could we do something also for the judges? And that led to a stream of work. And then I went to a conference in Germany at the Max Planck Institute in 2008. They asked me to present that paradigm shift paper.
They did. So it's still out there. This paradigm shift paper is still
I
floating
know.
around.
Crazy. But yeah, anyway, but it was with experimental philosophers also at the conference. Totally opened my mind to a whole new set of research questions and how we could. And yeah, I went to the behavioral summer camp, in grad school, and but just sort of being able to bridge the behavioral experimental economics approach to asking these types of questions, I think, then led to subsequent years of work of trying to get at better revealed preference measurements of what people think is fair and just, or their deontological, commitments, their moral views. And yeah, I feel like I'm skipping ahead while
No,
you're
no,
still
no.
talking
Well, you
about
know, it's
the law school.
funny. It's funny. I'm thinking of this kid going to all these libraries, getting all these books, and it's like I'm listening to an adult doing the same thing. Jump, going into so you've just continued to be very, very curious and make it work for you. I mean, because I could imagine someone at some point in your life saying you need to focus more. And you've always, it seems like you've just known a little bit about who you are. Is that right? You've known what you've got to do to be your best self.
I've known what questions are interesting to me, and yeah, for sure, I'm not answering them in a kind of linear, sort of methodical way. It's often, I think, this is a little bit of the influence of Michael Kramer and his earlier work of things that are kind of unexpected, synapses that then let me kind of return and answer some of those questions, even if at the moment there's no specific way to answer them. But yeah, no, I was definitely told to focus.
Well,
But
I mean, sometimes that advice is the right advice, and sometimes it's not the right advice. Why do you think it's been The why do you think it's the that that's not the right advice per se globally for you? What is it about your personality that your brain needs to be doing this kind of thing to be why is that in your production function?
I mean, to be sure, like when you're on a project, on a paper, when one focuses, and whether it's like not letting go, drilling into every single rabbit hole, and like really, really wanting to know, and so forth. I think that's still there and is reflected in some papers and presentations that I give where there's so many buttons and it's excuse me. And then I think also it's kind of like retrospective opportunities where you look back and you say, oh, this kind of all fits together in a way, even if I didn't have that specific label. So, excuse me, one second. So when I was at Chicago doing my postdoc, I think Steve Levitt once said, oh, one way to characterize your over here is, how market forces interact with normative commitments. I think that was a good way to kind of capture and then also bring the foundations for the subsequent work that I was then going to do. And so I think every now and then, doing that to yourself, whether it's like you're applying for grants or whether you're writing. I think Lewis Kaplow at Harvard Law was giving kind of like, oh, every 5 years or every 2 years, he just kind of writes himself. This is like a document that characterizes or focuses himself. And I think in a way that is how I work, but not everyone, works that way. Also, I should emphasize that sometimes it's teaching opportunities that give the ability to do this self-structure, but non-structure, you know what I mean? And so whether it's like theorizing cultural differences, the economics of fundamentalism that I was doing at Chicago, or hermometrics, which is like hermeneutics and econometrics.
Oh, you make that up? I've never heard of that.
As far as I know, I think it's a neologism. But yeah, it was something I was teaching when I was at Harvard Law to the undergrad econ students.
Oh, wait, what is that? What is Herman metrics?
Hermometrics. Well, okay, so first human hermeneutics is like interpretation. Econometrics is like measurement. So a play on words, but then also I went through different ways of thinking about the economics of interpretation. So like incentive, I don't like different ways of, interpretation as we saw it, whether from religious or legal texts. Another would be like
Did you say hermeneutics responding to incentives? Did you just say that?
yes.
Oh, I've never thought of that. Wait, so give me an example.
So the political economy of beliefs project that I mentioned just a few minutes ago is one example. So that explains the patterns in the US, but I was saying, well, but it depends if there is a large religious constituent for the elites to kind of care about. If you anyway, it was about like church state separation. So if you have to separate church and state, then the government is competitive against the religious constituency. But if you don't, then you'd be more pro welfare. What are the elite incentives to separate church and state? And that's like a separate piece. But additional interpretations, that also is, interpretations up the gazoo.
How far did you end up going with that? Well, what's the econometrics you're doing? What's on the left-hand side and the right-hand side of that?
Sure. So another part was let's do the random assignment of interpreters.
Oh, yeah.
So, I know you're interested in like the genealogy of econometric slash
Yeah.
ideas. So my co-author and I, so she was a Harvard PhD at the time, and we took our first application. This is back in 2008 on what is the effects of sexual harassment law on
Oh.
gender inequality, and because ex ante, there's law and econ perspectives on it's just a mandated benefit and or illegal regulation, but there is also alternative theories of like insider outsider involuntary unemployment and so forth. Anyway, so she presented it. Guido Imbens was, in the audience and was like, "Why are you just using political party and gender? You have lots of other biographical characteristics." And that's how the paper with Chris Hansen and Viktor Chernyzhukov and Alex Belloni came into being, of like, here's like a high dimensional set of instrumental variables that are possibly feasible.
Get out of here.
And then, yeah,
That's where it was born? That's
I
where
mean,
that like Ivy Lasso kind of stuff was born out of that?
they were working on stuff theoretically,
Yeah.
mathematically. But Chris was a close classmate, and continued to bounce ideas, and we and so
You know,
we
I just used your paper in a paper that I just published at JHR, where we used Ivy Lasso, because we had a lot of randomized clinicians at Booking, and we were looking at the effect of the being classified mentally ill on about amongst these inmates. But I was meant to tell you that. Wow, that is so fascinating, huh? I mean, how far did you end up doing work on this hermeneutic econometrics? I mean, did you ever show this to people like in, I mean, like people in law would probably find that fascinating. People in literature would find it fascinating, even in religion.
I mean, anecdotes. I did a talk. I was yeah, Tyler Cohen thought it was an interesting neologism, and Alana Kagan also. No, I have it. I taught it twice.
But it's like it kind of gets into the idea that the text is living because literally it's endogenous to these people who are responding to incentives in some way. Is that right? Yeah. Wow. That's an original idea. Huh. That's pretty crazy. What data set do you need to do something with like that? What is the ideal data set?
Sure. I started to collect all the court cases
Court cases, yeah.
in the US, in part to, first, it's building off the shoulders of others, of course. There was like this 5% random sample that NSF sponsored, like data collection of. And then I was like, well, let's see what happens if we get the 100%. There were, we have this paper that looks at the effects of, economics training on federal judges and in the subsequent decision making, their writing, their habits of mind, sentencing disparities, sentencing harshness. So, introducing judges to a paradigm.
That's a
No,
great segue. That's the paper I wanted to talk about. That's the Ideas Have Consequences paper with Elliot Ash and Suresh Naidu. Okay. So can you just sort of give the elevator pitch of that for the sake of the reader that I think actually people have heard of this paper, but they're gonna be excited to hear that hear it again here. What's this paper about?
sure. So starting in the 1970s, there was this training program for US judges, about like 20 every summer. Part of the controversy around this was the training program was funded by large corporate donors, almost all of whom would be litigating at some point in front of these judges. And nevertheless, it was presented as like a objective, here we are teaching you economic ideas, micro 101, but also like the Chicago sort of law and economics view of the world.
So it's not started by like Chicago. It's started by what? What's the group that's starting it?
So it was started by a former Chicago law faculty,
Oh.
Henry Manny. And he was on the spectrum of economic ideas, was a little bit more out there. For instance, saying that insider trading is economically efficient, and profit is like the only dimension through which one should consider social welfare. But yeah, no, it was in the South of Miami, seemed like it was like a resort type of hobnobbing for the judges. But you know, there was also a lot of rigorous like teaching, like 6 days a week, 9 a.m., 7 p.m., getting homework assignments. And there's lots of testimonials from the judges saying how much they really appreciated the teaching. And
Are they getting
have
paid? Are the judges getting paid to be in this thing?
they're I'm not aware. They're not that maybe it was like the travel foundations would be
Oh,
covered.
but they hold it in a super nice place.
They
So
hold
they're
it.
like, they're swimming and stuff in the Caribbean or whatever.
I don't know. There's no pictures of that. And then the journalists didn't talk about that. But yeah, no, I mean, just reading like the older court cases, you can really see how much they are potentially struggling with economic concepts.
Like give me an example. What's an example they're struggling with?
Well, so a lot of these cases have like economic ideas floating in the background, and then you have to, you know, whether it's like antitrust, you know, what is competitive? What does it mean? What is competitive behavior? Right. So that definitely had some paradigm shifts over the last century in terms of what are the right ways for judges to think about antitrust. But the examples of like economic ideas and so forth that I use when I teach or present the paper is comes from contract law, where you know, when you have a contract, and you know, people typically think there's a duty to keep a promise. You know, we shouldn't be allowed to breach. But there is this economic concept called efficient breach theory. So two parties, one of
Who's that
them,
associated with?
there was a 1977 Law Review article. Don't remember exactly the author, but Richard Posner wrote it into this 1985 or so circuit ruling.
Suppose you're one of the people teaching at this thing?
He was not. So, or not that we see from the FOIA requests. Like predominantly economics professors, Paul Samuelson, Milton Friedman.
Do you have in the data how much these guys are getting paid to do this?
I do not.
What have you heard anecdotally? Is it altruism? Milton Friedman's just wanting to spread the gospel of economics, or is it like they're getting paid?
Don't know, but
I mean, I could imagine it's altruism. That would be easy to imagine.
we can probably ask some of those instructors. I think early after I was teaching at the very end.
So it goes on for how many years?
It goes on until 1998.
So you know the names, and it's judges, right? It's judges that are going.
Correct.
And so you know their names. And so you can match them with their pre-treatment court rulings, post-treatment court rulings. Is that right? How labor intensive was it to get all that data?
The court rulings or
Yeah,
the training?
the court rulings.
Yeah, the court rulings. It was pretty labor intensive. So at least at the time, you know, people hadn't released public stuff, and so we followed a NSF sponsored approach of clicking and saving
Oh,
cases. So we click
that's
and
what NSF says, you can click and save.
That's right. And so like the NSF team posted like the state court data and was like, okay, I'm going to Zurich now. There's a research fund and I now have folks clicking and saving. But then beyond that, you need to start cleaning it. And so that took a very long time. And then we're building off of that 5% sample. So we're like, all right, these are a bunch of variables that previous research thought relevant. So let's also try to get that. And as we were doing the regular string expression parsing, we just make sure that we're matching that 5%
Is it a
sample.
lot of regular expressions when you're doing this kind of thing, or is it something really exotic?
This is back in 2013, 2014. So it was regular string expression parsing.
So what are you, so you ha how do you, well, you get like a dictionary ahead of time that's like measuring something kind of important, or what's the deal?
We are, you know, One window, you have the original HTML. One window, you're looking at what your code is outputting, and then you're just manually checking constantly. That's
Yeah. But I
way.
mean, like, if you're running a Probit or something and you're like, what's the probability you're going to say this? You're going to talk about some Coasean idea. It would seem like you've got to have some prior things you're trying to categorize.
Oh, okay. All right. All right. So moving to the economic analysis. Yeah. So we, this, we use like word embeddings, I guess nowadays the usual approach of you learn a word from its context to understand, how economic, a thing
Oh.
is. And we use a set of words that previous, well, we did two things. One is we took like JSTOR, we have all the economics articles.
Oh,
The
yeah.
other is like 10 or so phrases that legal scholars had identified as representing law and economics concepts.
Like, what's one?
Cost benefit.
They didn't say that. That was not a common way a judge would talk in terms of. Why? What's that mean? Because that's like making some sort of, it's not just making some sort of normative statement, it's a quantifying normative statement. Is that the idea?
It's a, I think of it as, so jargon is not the right term, but it's
Yeah.
like a parsimonious way to think about a more complex concept.
I
And then when you
see.
bring that parsimony into your head, not only can it describe it in a more precise manner, it
Yeah.
also catchy because there's just fewer words.
But so is that like the point of the paper? Is the point of the paper like they're using econ words, or is the point of the paper like their judgments are shifting?
Judgments are shifting. We can see, so over like this 80-year time period that the NSF data set collected, you can see like a huge shift in increasing conservativeness in terms of and especially in economics cases.
What's conservatism mean in this context? Like what?
Voting against government,
Voting against government?
voting against government regulation, voting for, pro-business, type things, or like child labor type of rules, do you vote? It's not.
What if you stratify the data and you have it like Democrats versus Republican elected judges? Is it still there?
So these are not elected judges, these are like tenured appointed judges.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Really,
Do you
really,
know their baseline political affiliation, though?
you have the party of appointment, so they're
Ah.
appointed by president, approved by Senate and stuff. And yes, this is all surviving controls for like Republican or
Everybody's shifting.
Republicans. You can actually see that Democrats are also going to this program.
Oh, Elizabeth Pop Berman. I interviewed Elizabeth Pop Berman on her new book. 2 years ago, about the economic way of thinking in DC, kind of being, she was pretty critical, as kind of corruptive a little bit. But I mean, is this sort of part of a broader kind of change in governance that like the economists are having a lot of influence?
Probably. I mean, this is a period of, so the 1970s, like stagflation, Milton Friedman has a TV show. I mean, this, I think around the time the Nobel Prize started. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to think economics was having its moment and
Right.
like improve society, structure the world and so forth. But that said, we are looking at the exact date of the judges going, and that there's no, it's not like there's a pent-up demand that we see reflected in either the writings or decision patterns. We even see the decisions flipping in the direction of on like labor and environment, and you can also
Labor and environment ends up getting dinged a little bit.
this is not like they're already having like a decision preference and then they get ideas that help them justify their decisions. It's like the ideas from those seminars seem to have changed how they think about these regulations. And you can see tons of quotations from the economists who are teaching about labor and environmental regulations in a way
Yeah.
that you'd think today is a little startling to read. But so I just wanted to give the final punchline on this. So we can explain between 25 to 40% of the secular trend
Yeah.
in shifting judges' votes, this pro-market orientation, just from the training program. That's not even thinking about spillovers. So that's comparing the treatment and control. We get those, reduced form estimates that it's such and such effect size. But the control, you get randomly assigned to an economics trained judge. That also affects you. In addition, you need to cite precedent that is now infused with economics. So once you've taken into account that, well, that's the next project.
Oh, wow.
And that.
Wow. Has this been a fun project? Have you enjoyed it?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
It.
What makes you really love a project when you sort of look back and you say, I really had a great time on that project?
I think in some ways, if there's like a rich way to analyze or answer that question within the data scope or something. So there are like many different ways to analyze. Okay, so that's one answer. Another answer is obviously like being able to explain historical change and all the stuff that we talked about at the beginning of the
Yeah.
Zoom. And that data rat like
Yeah.
perspective, there's just tons and tons of data, and then being able to, yeah, there's like a psychological aspect of this too, right? So why are the judges being, affected? Yeah, I mean, it in some ways, so this project has its own legs and stuff because it creates that richness that you can kind of get lost while you're doing the study. And another one that is an example is I was looking at the death penalty during World War I. They
Oh.
would sentence 3,000 soldiers, but only executed about 10%. So, and easy kind of analysis is like, well, what's the causal effect of execution on subsequent desertion within the
Oh, deterrence type stuff.
parents type stuff. But I had the names of all the soldiers. So you can have Irish versus non-Irish, at least approximation, and you can see that you're spurring. So it's like reducing legitimacy if you execute an Irish soldier. But that's just like the TLDR. It's like all the data that was then digitize. Oh, there's desertion. You can either just use the death sentence data. Oh, that's just a spreadsheet. That's not too hard. Oh, but now there are these police gazettes published in the UK, newspaper archives, war diaries from like, someone taking a picture of handwriting, all the casualties data, all the like geolocation of like units moving around, and so maps, right? And
Oh, yeah.
all the officers that were like moving from, one place to another. This is just this richness to kind of analyze that setting that made it kind of you're losing track of
So
time.
it's not just that you have diverse ideas. A big part of it is this what you call it a data rat. You collect the way that people collect stamps, you're collecting data. And you're using a variety of data sources in these projects, just way more than probably normal, like than in a typical econ paper. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. And then another hat we haven't really talked about is like giving people the tools to collect their own data.
Yeah, right.
O-Tree project, that was the experimental philosophy, measuring normative commitments, and then a toolkit for others to reduce 90% of the time. You have a thought experiment on what you want to measure, and then having data on your hands. So
What was
that.
O-Tree again? What's O-Tree for the sake of the listener?
Sure. So O-Tree is a open source programming language for researchers, economists, political scientists, sociologists, even psychologists, to collect data in typically in strategic interaction settings. That was its original sort of comparative advantage because relative to the status quo, you had some kind of like C++ type language that was closed source, and this is like Python, it's online, it's modular, etc. made it much easier to ask new questions because the code was much more flexible.
Yeah.
You know, copy pasting like 300 lines of code to do like a simple thing, it's now like maybe 10 lines of code.
Got it.
And so I like to maybe even bridges back to my original sets of interests, which is like now if we have a tool that helps people better understand other people, you know, we can increase recognition, respect, so we have a more just society. But also it's it's a tool for studying decision making, testing like different theories. And then the last couple of years, there's a whole nother Zoom call probably, which is pivoting O-Tree to like supporting decision making. So we've started to do like O-Tree justice. So, you know, all this analysis of digital analytics and biases and, you know, machine learning on judges' writings and decisions. How can we, you know, now build tools that can support them and so forth going forward?
That's great. Well, I've kept you a little bit longer. I want to kind of just imagine for a minute, you could go back in time and you meet your younger self, and you could go back and tell them anything. That's one way of asking this question. But another way of asking the question is, you meet someone now, young person, like you, and they just really remind you of yourself when you were younger. Maybe they're in college, or maybe they're early in the MIT, but maybe for some reason they don't have as much confidence about, where to go or how to become the economist that you sort of know is in them. What kind of advice do you think those people need to hear?
Well, you know, keep those questions in mind. I mean, this is a little bit boilerplate, but you know, whether it's on paper or digital, we just keep a library of things that you might eventually, you know, want to pursue. And even if you have to put on the back burner for a little bit or 20 years, maybe eventually there's like some technology, whether it's someone solved a new theorem or the data or the programming or the collaborator or counterpart or whatever, like any of these can help, you know, bring those earlier ideas into to fruition. And then just keep pushing through, I guess. So
Well, thanks so much, Daniel, for being on the show. It's been such a delight for us. We met 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I'm looking forward to us becoming friends. I hope that happens. It's really nice to have you on the podcast.
likewise, thank you. It's great to see you again.